Hello and welcome to this episode of NESRI's podcast. I'm Rob Robinson, a member of the Human Right to Housing team at NESRI. I'm also a member of the leadership committee of the Take Back the Land movement, and I'm based in New York City. Today we'll hear some highlights from the Take Back the Land housing panel at this year's LEFT Forum, which took place at Pace University in June. We'll hear from organizers and activists in the housing movement from around the country as they discuss the challenges and successes they've had in the struggle to secure our fundamental human right to housing. Program forward, and I'm going to have the folks introduce themselves. We think the way they do their work truly transforms the way we look at housing and land, and that's the way we see the work of Take Back the Land. So we'll start on my far left and ask the panelists to introduce themselves and come across. Give me your name, your organization, and just quickly how long you've been doing this work.
My name is Willie Gerald Fleming, co-founder of the Chicago Anti-Eviction Campaign, local action group with Take Back the Land. I've been organizing for about 20 years, 4 years with the Anti-Eviction Campaign, 15 years in housing.
My name is Max Ramon. I'm with the Take Back the Land and been with Take Back the Land since 2006.
So before I ask Max to come up here and join me, I don't know if any of you read this past Sunday's New York Times magazine section. Two of the stars of that magazine section are members of the Chicago Anti-Eviction Campaign. J.R. Fleming, step up. Stand up. Toussaint Losier in the audience. Stand up. An incredible piece. You know you got to be doing big time work if the New York Times features you in their magazine section. So props to my brothers from Chi-Town. I'm going to ask Max to come up now, and many of you know we've been advertising this as sunsetting the Take Back the Land movement, and you know everybody wants to know what sunset means. That means we're putting Take Back the Land to rest. A little tough to say, right? It's been a part of what we've both been doing for a long time. Myself, 4 years, and Max for the better part, 7-8 years. In 2009, March of 2009, I had an opportunity as a member of Picture the Homeless to travel down to Miami and learn from this incredible organization. And we were, at the time at Picture the Homeless, we were trying to figure out how to move a piece of legislation that would effectively have the city doing a vacant building count, because we thought there was a paradigm problem with homeless people sleeping on the street and large numbers of vacant buildings existing around the city. And we wanted to change that dynamic. And, you know, we kept sitting down and talking with the city, and they kept discounting whether or not there were vacant spaces or not. So we found a way. We started looking for radical ways to get our point across. And we came across the work that was happening in Miami at the time. And Take Back the Land had just come off of Umoja Village, where they had vacated a piece of property in central Miami, and had taken that piece of property and made it available to people who were homeless on the streets, and figured out a way that that piece of land could serve the community and the community could control it. So in March 2009, myself, three other members, went down to Miami, learned from what Take Back the Land was doing, and it was an incredible transformation for me personally, I think, as well as the other Take Back the Land members. We actually, well, I'll start off first. You heard a piece in the video from the Trody family who were featured in Michael Moore's film, Capitalism, A Love Story. And Max took me to meet Mary Trody and the rest of the family. And at the time, I recorded a piece of audio for her. I do a radio show here in New York called Global Movements, Urban Struggles. And Max left us alone in the room, and I had a very personal conversation with Mary about what it meant to have that home liberated to her. And it was something that just affected me in a way that I just can't explain. It transformed me. It humanized, really put a human face to the struggle and what people were going to. And Mary was very open to me. She said, Rob, this isn't a beautiful place to some. It's probably a hole in the wall to a lot of people, but it was our home, and we appreciate living here. And she was so grateful for what Max did, and I realized how powerful that was and what that meant to Mary. I think the next thing that really just pushed us out there and started thinking about how we move this work from Miami and make it broader. Max and I had the opportunity to speak together. We have folks here from Baltimore at a conference called The City from Below in Baltimore in 2009. And we were on a panel with David Harvey, We're members of United Workers, Steve Meacham from City Life, Vita Urbana, Poverty Initiative members from here in New York. And it was called Radical Organizing in the 21st Century. And it was really folks who were just looking at this work different and really taking a militant stand towards the human right to housing. And it was very powerful. And it just really formed a bond. But we came away, Max and I started talking, what happens if we move this work along the East Coast? Steve Meacham and City Life are doing great eviction defense up in Boston. You know, picture the homeless is starting to do this work in New York. And they've been doing it in Miami for a while. So what does it look like nationally? Well, we continued to talk that summer, and then it ended up in September 2009. We ended up Labor Day weekend in Atlanta at Kali Akuno, who is the director of the Malcolm X grassroots movement, invited us and a bunch of other folks in the movement down to his house in Atlanta, and that's where we launched Take Back the Land National with the call to action for May 10th, 2010. And it was incredible. We got some incredible actions in different cities, and especially in cities we didn't expect to have good actions in, right? I think Max and I both thought that we were going to have the great actions in all these urban centers, but it happened in places like Madison, Wisconsin, and Toledo, Ohio, with Keith Sadler and the foreclosure group in there, and in Portland, Oregon, places we didn't expect. But we actually lifted up stories of people all around the country, and people became invigorated around this work. But we've gone through a lot of iterations of what Take Back the Land is. We've engaged local action groups. We supported the Chicago folks when they moved Martha Biggs, who was also featured in that article that I just mentioned. We supported those folks in Chicago. And I think JR will tell you that was also a time where you could see the adrenaline and what it meant to people to participate in this type of work and really exercise self-determination for social change, right? People were invigorated. People who had never done it before said, this totally makes sense. And people came together and fought for it. But we think we've come together and we think we've missed a moment, right? I don't want to say missed a moment. We've lifted this work to a certain point, and it's kind of leveled off, right? And we didn't get it to a point that we thought it should be for a number of reasons, right? And instead of me laying out those reasons, I'd rather pay homage to Max, who taught me what I know, to step up and then just talk about that in a real way. So, Max, if you could just come up and talk about some of the reasons why.
So, first of all, thank everyone for coming out, and thank you again to the Left Forum for making this space available for us to have this discussion. So I want to go over two things here, spend a little bit of time talking about the decision to sunset Take Back the Land, and then focus and shift, and then hopefully we'll spend the substantial amount of the panel time talking about what some of the next steps are. The next steps are for the movement, the next steps are for real hard left progressive work. So to start out with, just in terms of Take Back the Land and sunsetting, Take Back the Land started in the fall or late summer of 2006 in Miami, Florida, where the real estate boom was at its harshest, and that's what the media called it, was a real estate boom, and that's what the politicians wanted to think of it as. But for many communities, particularly communities of color, we experienced that as a period of gentrification, of harsh gentrification. And I think it was the first national wave of gentrification that was happening. So it was happening in Miami as kind of like the epicenter. And so we really were created in response to that. Take Back the Land, we'll go into all the elements here, but was a very specific response to a particular historic moment. And that historic moment was all of these, was the gentrification crisis, which is happening in extreme way in low-income communities, immediately followed by exactly what we expected, which was a bust in the real estate bubble, and therefore all these foreclosures, which we didn't expect it to reach that level. When it happened in Miami, then, of course, we began the process of identifying these vacant government-owned and foreclosed units, breaking into them, and as we say, moving homeless people into peopleless homes. So we started as a very particular and specific response to this historic moment, and therefore, when that historic moment comes to a close, when people aren't thinking about things in the same way they were thinking about it before, then it seems to us that it makes sense to then close the response to that moment as well. So if we started out because there was this huge opportunity around this particular phenomenon, and then that phenomenon dissipates or it's no longer around or it's on its way down, then it doesn't make sense to continue to fight with the exact same response that we did to begin with. The thing that got us started was no longer there in the same way, so we can no longer respond to that thing in the same way. Otherwise, we'll just be making a mistake. We'll be banging our head up against the wall. So when we first started talking about building Take Back the Land and when we ultimately built it, we even talked about automatically sunsetting over a certain amount of time. We ended up not doing that for a number of reasons. But we talked about, for example, in 5 years, pick a date, and in that time we would dissolve and all go out and start something new. But that was not something that we wanted to do. So it was a very difficult decision, but it was a necessary decision, we feel, in order to move forward and to tackle the new challenges that are coming up. So I want to spend a few moments talking about just a few, very briefly, a few of the lessons and observations that we have, and then again shift to the to what we think is happening in the future. So in terms of the observations and things that we found, we want to talk about three of them. We had probably about 15 or 20 in all that we identified as observations, both things that prevented us from moving forward and just things that happened during this time. But just want to very quickly touch on three. First is positive action. We talked about positive action and Take Back the Land quite a bit, and we developed a term. It is a continuation of a term created by Kwame Nkrumah, the first president of the Freed Ghana, in which he talked about positive action as the things that we need to do in order to liberate and decolonialize Africa and liberate Africa. We talk about positive action as a escalation from civil disobedience. So if you think about direct action as engaging in these hardcore actions in order to express your unhappiness with the law, and you talk about civil disobedience as an escalation from that, and civil disobedience is not just breaking any law, but it's breaking the specific law with which you have moral objection, that is civil disobedience. We talk about positive action as enforcing moral laws, not just breaking immoral laws, which is civil disobedience, but enforcing moral laws. So we think the police evicting a family who's lost its job from their home because they don't have enough money to give a bank, we think that is immoral, and we feel we have a moral obligation to stand up and fight against that. But not only that, do we have a right to civilly disobey those immoral laws and the imposition of those immoral laws, but we also have an obligation to implement moral laws. We also think it's immoral to have homeless people on the street and empty houses on the other side of the street. So we not only have an obligation to prevent evictions from happening, but we also have an obligation to take the people who are living on the street and move them into the houses that are sitting there vacant, serving no social good. So we talked about positive action. We exercised it. It was not only an escalation, but it was a real way, real tangible way, to build a movement by getting people actively involved in their own liberation and in their own struggle and taking their liberation in their own hands. In addition, as mentioned, it helped us implement our own public policy. And those were the kind of the theories behind why we did it. We wanted to implement our own public policy, we wanted to help build a movement, spark a movement by engaging in these powerful actions. But it was another thing that we discovered while doing this. We had an eviction defense that we launched in Rochester, New York, with Take Back the Land Rochester. A woman named Catherine Lennon, her husband died of brain cancer. He was the main breadwinner. After he died, she was unable to pay the mortgage. He did not leave a will. And she was unable to pay the mortgage, and she was foreclosed on, and they were getting ready to evict her. So Take Back the Land Rochester organized around her, organized the community, and launched an eviction defense. And for 2 weeks straight, while the eviction period was open in Rochester, they sat in front of the door from, I think it was 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., whenever it was legally allowed in New York City, to do evictions, and they prevented the police from doing the eviction. Police would drive by, see them all there, they'd have cameras, et cetera, and then the police would drive off. 2 weeks and 1 day later, the police came with a SWAT team. And SWAT team, something like 15 police cars, and full geared down SWAT team, semi-automatic weapons, and moved us out, arrested, I think it was six of us and one neighbor, and evicted Catherine Lennon from her home at gunpoint. And so obviously she was out of house, and she ended up couch surfing for the next few months, trying to get herself together. Got a lot of media attention. And then after that, there was no real motion, even though it got media attention, even though elected officials got involved, there was no real motion on the negotiations with the bank to try to get her back in the home. So we did the only thing that we felt at that point was the natural thing to do, is we broke back into the house and moved her back in. And this was about 3 months or so after she was evicted in the first place. So not that long after we did that, they realized they were unable to evict her, and the bank offered her a new mortgage. And this was the first, I think, time. This is, of course, now it's ubiquitous. Everyone is getting more, new mortgages and principal reduction. But I think this was the first time someone had gotten a new mortgage post foreclosure, post eviction, and post showing up on the television saying we're breaking back into the house. And we practically did it on live TV. So what we concluded is that we had all the theories about what would be positive action, but what engaging in positive action campaigns demonstrated to us is that the law is for suckers, right? The really powerful and really wealthy don't have to pay attention to it, and those communities that are really well organized also don't have to pay attention to it. And this, them saying to us that, well, you can't have this house because you were foreclosed on, or you didn't sign this paperwork, it didn't mean anything, because if we could muster up enough power, we could actually do exactly what we wanted to do, and that's what we did in that case. So that was a positive action. A couple statements on the nonprofit industrial complex. Take Back the Land made a deliberate decision not to become a 501c3. And we did so because we felt like we had too great a number of our social justice forces in the 501c3 industrial complex. And what that did was that while it, on one hand, it professionalized a lot of the organizing that happened, it also prevented those who were in that space from exercising their full range of creativity for two reasons. One is you get a 501c3, you kind of make a deal with the government where they say, okay, we're going to give you nonprofit tax-free status, but in exchange, you're not allowed to break the law, you agree that you're not going to break the law, and you agree that you're never going to challenge us for power, which means you can't run anyone for office, you can't support anyone for office, et cetera. And that's the deal that's made, which, you know, in some cases you could say that's not a bad deal, but either way, it's a deal. Out of this time, we have found, and certainly that's been made valid by Occupy, we must have segments of this movement that are not in the 501c3 industrial complex. It gives more power to those who are there, and it gives us a broader range of political activity in which we can participate. In addition, we don't have the other problem of funders, of people who have a lot of money who we are often protesting, putting money out in a trail that drives us away from where we actually want to go. We actually think that this plays a significant role in why we felt like the time came for Take Back the Land to sunset. We think that this is a time in history, even though this particular moment we think the window is closing, there are other windows that are opening up, and this time still generally is a time for us to make advancements. We think we, as a movement, must be way more ambitious in our reach and in our objectives and in our vision than we have been as of late. With the recent actions that happened last year around eviction defenses and continue to happen around eviction defenses in particular, we have for the first time hundreds and thousands literally of people who are going out doing eviction defenses, who are going out and blocking the street, who are going out and protesting banks and doing all kinds of amazing, amazing work and incredible actions. And then when the media comes and when those in power come and they say, okay, what are your demands? The only thing we're seen to be able to muster is we want this person who owed all kinds of money to get a brand new mortgage from the bank, and we want them to pay the bank back, although we want the mortgage to be at a reduced rate. We cannot build a movement, we assert, based on the idea that people get principal reduction or somehow we can't have a movement that's based on preserving people's equity in their home ownership. Right. We can't build a movement based on that. We can build a movement on the human right to housing. We can build a movement on community control over land, but we can't build a movement based on principal reduction. We cannot build a movement based on small and short-thinking goals. We have to reach for the most ambitious goals we could possibly have. We need to be reaching for the human right to housing realized in the United States in our lifetime, and we need to be reaching for community control over land in the United States. We don't think of this as a end, but as a transition from one historic moment into another historic moment. So the question for us is not should Take Back the Land stay around forever or what should we do next. We don't want to go through the trouble of trying to reinvent ourselves every 2 or 3 years to remain relevant. We want to instead focus on doing the work that we are supposed to be doing. So what is happening next? You know, the one of the scenes that I remember most vividly when Take Back the Land started was, well, we were already around at this point, but when we started to go national, was during the 2008 presidential election, when it was clear the economy was about to collapse. And Obama and McCain both took time off of their campaign schedule to go back to Washington and do their dog and pony show. And they were meeting behind closed doors in order to save the world economy, supposedly. And we all know what came out of that. But what stuck with me most was not only just the general sense of panic that was, people who were near retirement age, my family members were worried that their entire retirement savings would be wiped out. but how silent the left was. We were there collectively hoping that Barack Obama, then a candidate, not even president, would somehow be able to come in and save the day and make sure that he takes care of the economy and save us all. The left was not out on the street. We were not making any visible demands. We were caught completely and totally flat-footed in the biggest, potentially the biggest economic crisis of our lifetime. We were completely and totally flat-footed. We cannot be put in that position again. So as we discuss what happened then and the way that that the crisis was covered up, one thing that we used to say a lot was, and still do, was that it seemed like, as a result of the real estate bust, there was this big, gigantic crater in the economy, at least in the real estate economy. A $700 billion, that's the official number they gave, but of course we know it was more, but $700 billion crater that was there that was destroying the economy. You couldn't drive over it, you would sink in, you couldn't get around it, it was too wide, it was gigantic. And that crater was covered up with TARP money. With $700 billion of public money, where it was just filled up with, instead of dirt, they just filled it up with cash and flattened out the road so people could use it again. And it stabilized that part of the economy. And so as we talked about this with academics and with economists, you know, I said, well, look, this is, it looks like they're going to stabilize this thing. And here's this historic moment. We're going to lose this historic moment because they basically filled up this thing with cash instead of with dirt. And what particularly the late, great Neil Smith pointed out, but a few others did also, was that they didn't materialize this dirt that they filled up this huge crater with. There's a crater which was very real, this hole. They didn't just materialize, they didn't invent it, they didn't manufacture it in a lab. They had to take it from somewhere. And where they took it out of was the public sector. They took $700 billion worth of dirt or cash or whatever it was, you know, to fill up that crater on this side by removing it from that side. Which suggests then that the next major crisis we're going to experience is going to come because of a shortfall happening on the public sector. Not in the private sector. This closing of schools that's happening all over the United States, closing of rec centers, et cetera, is just a forewarning, we think, of what the next crisis is going to be. We must be better prepared. We have to position ourselves today to deal with, make demands around, and organize around the crisis which comes tomorrow. Thank you.
So, thank you, Max. You heard Max mention Neil Smith. Neil Smith was one of those academics that was truly a friend of Take Back the Lands. He passed away last fall, and he was really tight with Max and myself and always made his class and his students available to us. A lot of research was done through Neil's teaching. So, you know, I think Max and I both can say that we definitely miss Neil Smith, and, you know, may he rest in peace.
The next speaker is going to be Roy J.R. Fleming.
As the New York Times Magazine said, the J.R. stands for just righteousness. As the New York Times Magazine said, I'm not really concerned with the law. You know, we carry a book in our back pocket, most of the people in my campaign, and it's this Universal Declaration of Human Rights. You know, we consider ourselves an enforcement authority for the people because we tried everything. You know, I stand up here hurt today, you know. Take back the land at sunset. You know, we was in a critical moment, like Max said. And you'd think the funders would have been knocking your dough down because we tried everything. We tried policy. City government, state government, county government, federal government, United Nations. Nothing happened. We tried the policy route. We tried the traditional organizing route. None of that worked. We didn't try to reinvent a wheel. This was done in the 30s, right, Max? During the civil rights movement. Every generation had a role to play in this. But I think what Max keyed in on was the 501c3. You know, during the 30s, the 50s, the 60s, the 80s, and the 90s when they did it, they wasn't dependent on that 501c3. It was people power. The people seized the moment, and they supported it. And the people that was getting money, they supported it. Because they understood one thing to be true. Today, me, tomorrow, you. We still in that moment. Some people think the foreclosure crisis is going down here. True enough, yeah. It's not a crisis right now. But wait till you... they get into that other ditch that Max talked about that day. It took all the public sector money out. Now they're closing clinics. schools, taking people out. What's going to be left? This government has divested in the people. There's no more public sector. I keep hearing people saying, what public sector? There's no more public housing. They're getting rid of public schools, public health facility. There is no more public sector. Is there any more people in the public? This is my question. Where are the people when all of this is going on? I can testify they wasn't there for Take Back the Land. And at a point in time in history when activities of Take Back the Land was needed. At the anti-eviction campaign, the local action group of Take Back the Land, we don't ask the government to fund us to fix up houses. We make it clear in every home liberation we do. We don't ask no money for the banks. We don't ask for no money for the government. So we don't expect for no problems from the bank, and we don't expect for no problem with the government, right? And we didn't ask you for your money. This is the community. It's not the anti-eviction campaign doing these activities. We are just promoters. So when people ask me questions like, how do you see the left moving human rights to housing work forward? It's the messaging. It's the support mechanism. To make sure that these support mechanisms are in place, to make sure that these stories are being told so that the next generation, not our generation, the next generation will inherit some. I don't see us doing this type of activity if it did happen during the 30s, the 50s, the 60s, the 80s. Right? I don't see us taking this type of activity if the generation before us didn't invest their time and resources in providing that platform. A lot of folks talk about the human rights to housing. Is it obtainable in America? We shouldn't be looking for what's obtainable. We should be looking for what is needed right now in this place and time, right? We shouldn't be asking for certain things in this point in time. We should be demanding certain things. And we shouldn't be demanding things at press conferences, at forums. We should be demanding these things in the communities that most need these resources, right? Our actions should speak louder than our words. It hurts, you know, that Take Back the Land, you know, messaging was used by a lot of movements. Max didn't want to get into that. I'm going to get into it. You know what I'm saying? A lot of people don't want to get credit sometimes where credit is due. Most of you wouldn't even know who I am if it wasn't for that New York Times Magazine cover. Most of the local media didn't say nothing to us for 4 years we was doing this type of activity. You showed the clip with about 50 microphones out there. One News Network carried it, right, Rob? Y'all was in the city for that. One News Network. So where do we go from here, right? It's going to take a peer-to-peer system, like we're saying with Katrina, Rita, and Sandy, to keep movements going, to build movements. We're going to have to learn how to give, put our money where our mouth is. Collective work more than anything is going to be needed. In Chicago, we're starting to reach that point of collective work. We fight for the human right to housing, but people see us everywhere with everybody supporting. When our sisters and brother organization Stop took over mental health clinic, we helped support that. When parents at Whittier La Casita in Chicago wanted to take over school, we supported that because we see the connection between education, healthcare, and housing. The one connection we haven't been able to make, and I gotta say this, that they made in every other generation was with the labor community. At a time where they were going to be directly impacted by this foreclosure crisis, their unemployed skillsmen and craftsmen who were losing their home, this was a moment in which labor could have drawn the line, just like they do for Habitat for Humanity. Habitat for Humanity only survive and exist because of what? Their donated labor that they receive to keep their projects moving forward. At a time when so many skillsmen were losing their home, this was an opportunity for them to partner up, not just with non-for-profit, community development corporation, grassroots organizations, but partner with the people. We still have an opportunity to do that. Until we unite all our fights and build a collective movement, we'll never obtain a human right to housing, a human right to healthcare, a human right to education, or a human right to a living wage. Until we unite all our fights with collective work, we're just wasting our time. Thank you.
To someone's ear.
All right, so I'm gonna do my best to keep things short. I want to touch on a couple of things that I thought have been like particularly inspiring about Take Back the Land, because I think we in Chicago have benefited more recently from a fair amount of the national spotlight in terms of the work that we've been doing. And a lot of that comes out of the history of the Western Cape anti-eviction campaign and struggles against neoliberal policies that have been taking place in South Africa since the turn of the 21st century. And also comes out of the experience that folks who came out of public housing in Chicago, particularly Cabrini Green, brought with them out of the struggles to preserve public housing there. But we in Chicago also benefited a lot from the interactions that we had with folks in Take Back the Land, different opportunities when Max came and other folks from Take Back the Land came and sort of spoke with us, both, you know, sort of like public lecture style such as this and also more private kind of strategy conversations. And it's really that dialogue that we had both locally in Chicago and then just sort of more broadly in terms of having a sense of being part of a network of organizations that were wrestling with these issues, they really helped us, really helped to push us to doing what we now talk about regularly as enforcing the human right to housing and doing that by moving homeless families into what we like to call people-less homes, right? And that's something that came out of the organizing that we were already doing and kind of developed somewhat organically out of the histories of struggle that we brought to the table, but I think also came out of that interaction with Take Back the Land. So if we could offer the folks who have been at the forefront of organizing Take Back the Land a round of applause one more time, that would be, you know, I think that's well deserved. And just two quick points that I want to highlight that seemed to me like really salient kind of takeaways from just what Take Back the Land has been able to do is that one, it surprised me, and Rob spoke to this earlier, it surprised me that when Take Back the Land was really looking to make connections with organizations around the country, that the folks who were most interested in gravitating to what Take Back the Land was doing were in places like, Rochester, New York. And if, sir, if you could just wait for the end of the panel discussion.
Would you stop right now?
Let it go.
Sir,
let it go.
Don't take his flyer, please. You're out of order.
That sort of activity popped up in you know, places that those of us from Chicago or, you know, more prominent city consider to be random places out in the middle of, like, Rochester, New York, and Madison, Wisconsin. And I think part of what that shows is that the issues that we might be wrestling with in more prominent places are also really tangible in smaller cities as well. And I think one of the things that those of us who like to organize in, say, the housing sector don't think about enough is how do we make connections with people who are struggling around the same sort of issues but are doing so in cities that have less prominence and also offer some degree of opportunity because there's less of a crowded field in terms of the number of organizations there, right? And so particularly young people who are looking to find an opportunity to plug into some of this work and take it forward might not have as easy an opportunity in terms of finding a place to fit in. So I think there's a lot of potential for groups that are doing this sort of work, whether it's housing or in other areas, to look at, to adapt almost like a sort of reverse Walmart style of organizing in terms of saying what does it look like to do some of this work in the Arkansas and the small towns in Missouri aside from just the Chicago, New Yorks, and what have you. The other thing that I think is also worth speaking to some degree is just from my own perspective, having worked with social movements in South Africa, to find it pretty inspiring where you can work with organizations that are not preoccupied with what the grant funding cycle looks like, how to plan for the site visit, right? Things of that nature to sort of try and say, okay, we're going to kind of give our middle finger to the, nonprofit industrial complex, and we're going to just do the work that needs to be done. The last thing I want to say is I just really want to emphasize the folks from Baltimore were sharing in terms of marrying the sword and the shield with the book, right? Because I think it's really essential that those of us who are trying to take on or move in the direction of some sort of transformative organizing, right, Organizing that's not simply focused on, okay, we need to take home a particular victory, or we need to take home a bill that gets passed or some sort of change of policy, but we want to do it in a way that transforms not only what our communities look like, but the way in which people think about issues of housing, issues of work, things of that nature, that we also really get more serious and rigorous about what we're doing in terms of political education and leadership development. And I think those are things that at this moment in time, a lot of organizations either don't do or they pay lip service to. And to really do a more rigorous job of pushing that forward and trying to get as good at that. We in Chicago have a lot of work to do in terms of getting as good as we can at doing that, as we are at finding a house, scouting it, breaking into it, allegedly. Right? Cleaning it up and making it habitable for a family. We also need to be and we do a fairly good job of criticizing ourselves at how long it takes us to do it, right? How we could always do it better. We also need to do a better job of pushing ourselves to do a better job of informing the folks that we're working with that, okay, we're gonna do what we can to enforce your human right to housing, right, to keep you from getting evicted, but at the same time, we need to sit down and study, okay, when we talk about human rights, what does that mean, right? When we talk about going through tenant court, what does that mean? Why are you paying rent in the first place, right? How is it that the structures of ownership of property operate in the way that you do? When you pay rent to a landlord, is that money really going to, cleaning up your house, or are you just paying your landlord's mortgage? Like, things of that nature are just the surface of the sort of conversations that we need to have, and we always need to do a better job of pushing those conversations forward. So thank you.
You've been listening to highlights from Take Back the Land panel at LEP Forum 2013. To learn more about the work of the Take Back the Land movement, visit www.takebacktheland.org. That's one word, takebacktheland.org. If you would like to learn more about the National Economic and Social Rights Initiative, visit www.nesri.org, NESRI.org. Thank you for listening, and enjoy your day.